Welcome back to the show. What an episode we have for you this week. We are joined by one of Berlin's big hitters from the data world, Steve Buckingham. He is a VP of data, has been a director of data, has experience in solutions architects, and coming from originally the politics scene. We're going to be talking about the identity crisis that data is going through, the journey that he's been on as it has evolved with old ideas being caught up by new technologies, and what he is excited for coming up this year. Enjoy. What is the biggest problem that data has with its identity at the moment?
I think it's probably fairly common to teams across at the moment. You know, the big problem is why? Like, why data teams? Why invest in these teams? What is the point of it? Why is it money well spent for the business?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not just a problem for data teams. It's a problem for teams right across industry now, particularly if you're in startup industries.
Yeah.
But it's, funnily enough, for teams that are working with data, it's a question we've not spent enough time trying to answer.
Mm-hmm.
It's a question that goes right back to almost the start of my career with data. I got into data working with politics, and that's a very different game.
Yeah.
But after that, I went to work for Sky. That inspiration has stayed with me my whole career. When we were at Sky, and when we were doing analytical projects, when we were doing dashboarding projects, when we were doing anything around information for the company,
mm-hmm.
she went into pretty much every project with, if we get this right, what is it worth? You know, if we get this right by retaining more customers, what is it worth? If we get this right by bidding the right amount for TV sports, what is it worth? If we get this right by improving acquisition, what is it worth? And we considered the analyst investment time that was going in and the data mm-hmm. engineering investment time that was going in. And in some ways, it was a bit easier because a lot of it was project-based.
Right.
But it meant that we were thinking about the cost and the return of every analytical project that we did. And it meant that Sky, as well as being incredibly customer-focused, as Sky has always been,
mm-hmm.
that Sky was seeing data much more as a profit driver, much more of a profit center right from the start. And there was never that question about, you know, resenting that money that you spend on the data team, because everything was ill-defined. Now, that was a, you know, tens of thousands person organization with super mature processes. And a lot of people listening to us today are in the startup world, where things are a bit different from that, a bit less defined, where we're changing our strategies maybe a bit more often.
Yeah.
And where we need to adapt. But I think it's a question we could answer more. Why are we doing something, and why is that valuable for the business? And we sometimes don't spend enough time with that lens on about why is what we're doing actually useful?
Hmm. Do you think it started like that and then it got forgotten and then we're starting to focus on it again?
I mean, I didn't work with every company at the time. I worked with a few companies. My impression is that, to a certain extent, Sky, particularly in the UK at the time, was more exceptional than the norm.
Right.
There were a few others in a similar space. Carphone Warehouse had a really good reputation back mm-hmm. in the day as well, in terms of customer centricity and thinking about how they use data. And, you know, there's some other inspirational companies that I remember from the time. They were called Top Right Group at the time. I think they've been through called Essential Conferencing Events type company.
Mm-hmm.
Really good driven work back in the day. But I think a lot of companies were doing fairly simple BI back then, and not necessarily with always super clear reasons. But I think the spend level was on average probably a lot lower than it is today. You know, most enterprises then, we're not talking about spending significant percentages of their income on their data functions. Whereas if you look at many startups today have got 7-8% of their staff base just on data or more. And that's a significant investment. And you've really got to justify that. And the tools on top are significant spend drivers as well. And you know, it was easy in the sort of 2020 through to 2022. It was almost like people were asking you, where do you want the extra staff this month? And no one was really asking why. And I think we all quite enjoyed that in a way. And I think we all thought we were delivering value, and hopefully we were delivering value, but we never thought enough about how or why or how do we justify this.
Yeah. Has that changed now? I mean, money's not cheap anymore. We've back end of 2022 is gone.
I think it's definitely changed now. I'm definitely thinking about, you know, how do I use every team member that I have well, and how do we use them well for the business? I've got great team members and they're doing great jobs and are working an exciting business, but we need to make sure, put a lot of effort into how do we keep aligned. You know, we need to make ourselves central to the strategy and the target setting process. You know, we need to be at the heart of, you know, a lot of companies are using OKRs and how at the heart of really being part of defining the OKRs, being part of measuring the OKRs, being part of delivering the OKRs, and how are we making sure that almost everything we do in our teams sort of lines up to that strategy, lines up to that strategy for the next year, for the next 2 years. And that we can go and not just know this within our teams, like going back to my time in politics, it's one thing to do it. It's another thing to make sure other people know about it.
Yeah.
So I think particularly on data leaders, but actually not just on data leaders, on everybody who's working with stakeholders across the business. And that, you know, in a data team, that should be just about everyone. Making sure everyone understands what we're doing and why, and sort of continually checking that we're aligned and how we can be doing it better. That's a way. It's a terrible thing to say that you, like, that's a way of protecting your team, because actually it shouldn't be about protecting your team. You protect your team by making your business successful. And when your business is successful and they recognize that part of that success comes from the fact that we can use our data well, comes from the fact that we can predict our customer acquisition costs, comes from the fact that we know our lifetime value, comes from the fact that we can make good recommendations, comes from the fact that we can drive good decisions from experiment results and lead to a more successful product. You don't need to go around protecting your team at that point, because your business is growing, because your business is successful, and they see that the data can be at the heart of that.
Has data potentially lost some value while the cost of it acquiring it has increased? Is data becoming less valuable?
Is data becoming less valuable? I don't believe it is becoming less valuable. I think it will become differently valuable. I think some things that used to be difficult will become easier, and other things will become possible. I think there's certain things that become less valuable in that that you really need to know your answers a bit more now. And therefore, probably like there's an increased value on quality and data quality. And so like there's less value on being approximately good enough. Quality isn't the same for every single use case. There's different levels of quality depending on, you know, if you're doing financial reporting or if you're doing finding some trends in some product funnel. There's maybe different measures to apply there. But I think that's a space where you bad data's become less valuable. Businesses have less room to make bad decisions, or to make bad decisions that are informed by bad data. But actually, in, you know, where we've got scarce resources, where companies have got less runway, making good product decisions quicker with good data is arguably more valuable. You know, doing a fake door test experiment, understanding the results of that and using that to help decide whether you invest in a fully fledged feature is arguably a lot more imperative and a lot more valuable when it's harder to get that next funding round, when you need to make your money stretch, when you need to show that you are have the potential to be a profitable and sustainable business. So now, I don't think it's become less valuable, but we need to think about it differently. It's you've got to be more focused.
Is speed and quality therefore more is a bigger factor than amounts that it maybe was in the past? Just gather as much as you can.
Speed and quality are, you know, in that example, they're both important, and they're real. Speed and quality are difficult. In that, if you want to have speed and you want to have quality, the way you have that, you need to have a really good process. If you don't have a really good process, for instance, good ways of testing your event data, good ways of having contracts in place on your production databases so you can understand what's coming in, good ways of implementing your tracking and your permissions so that you're sure the data that you can use, then it's very hard to move fast reliably. You can, you know, without having good process in place, you tend to be able to move fast, or you tend to be able to move at high quality, and it's very difficult to do both.
Right.
And I think that's a challenge that a lot of businesses have faced. And, you know, you need to take the opportunities that you can. And one of the advices I would give there is, you know, understand what's central to the difference that you bring and understand what isn't. And you don't need to invent your own wheel for the stuff that isn't your unique differentiating factor. Like, you know, in my current company, we've got an experimentation platform, sits on top of our data warehouse, works on top of our data warehouse so that the data remains local to us, super flexible, super good also at implementing feature flags and things. And so long as we deliver reliable event data to it, it can reliably segment people into what A, B, C, whatever group we want, and can then do a good job and repeatable job and a low effort job of getting us the basic experiment results, telling us when they're significant, and doing a lot of that repeatable work of getting you to the result. And so that's where we are using some basic investment in quality to get good data, to automate a result and allow us to move faster. And then we can spend more of our analyst time in that instance on why is the result? Where should we go next? We don't spend so much time on getting to the result, which of course a great analyst can get you to the result. A lot of that is repeatable maths, which with the right process can just be done. And actually, it's better to do that. It opens up experimenting to a lot more teams and to a lot more people to understand the basic results. And sometimes understanding the basic results is enough. Not every decision needs a deep dive. And so that's allowed us to focus our resources, our people. You know, our people. I talk about resources, really, I mean people. Where they can be most valuable.
I mean, 2020 to 2022, standards slipped. We were probably not disciplined across the whole industry. It sounds like these aren't groundbreaking new methods. It's just remembering best practices.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of groundbreaking new stuff out there. And some of it's valuable. And there's a lot we can learn from it. But you're also right that I think a lot of it isn't always as new as we like to think it is. And you know, you take something, I don't often talk about it, but I take data mesh as an example. Data mesh is a really exciting topic with this, a really exciting topic for opening up data within industry, within companies, particularly for how large and complex companies can work with data. you know, in recent years, you know, would have been different at Sky going back over a decade now. In recent years, I haven't been at a company that I feel would have needed data mesh to be efficient and effective with data. And therefore, in some ways, I've never really looked that much at adopting data mesh where I've been, because I haven't felt it's been the most urgent thing to think about.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that the principles, some of the principles you don't apply, like domain centricity, understanding data ownership, having good quality and contracts on the information that you publish, and making clear information available aren't things that we should follow. But it is absolutely true that those were things that we were following 10, 15, 20 years ago. It's absolutely true that when I was writing file extract specifications and file integration specifications back in 2012, that we were covering those topics. Now, we were covering them in a much less dynamic way, in a harder way to test. They were written in Word documents with tables attached to Excel documents at the time. But they were rigorously tested and rigorously thought about. And the whole process of extracting information was so difficult, so expensive. Like, you just had to try and get it right. Like, the penalty for getting it wrong was super high. And as we found it easier to move information about quicker, we did go through this space of like, well, let's just get the information out and try and make sense of it later. And that kind of came back to bite us, because then you got the information out, you tried to make sense of it later, and you found out that every 3 weeks the production database changed, and you never quite understand why, and it was never quite documented, and nobody quite owned that. And they said, well, can't you fix it in the data models in the middle? And then you've got a different change coming in every 3 weeks, and suddenly you've got an entire data team trying to keep up with the changes on the production database, with the exceptions that they write in their data model in the middle. And you've got a frustrated CFO sitting in the middle going, when can I make a decision about whether we're hitting our targets or not?
Yeah. So the technology's caught up with the ideas, that the ideas came too soon.
Yeah, and even with data mesh, like, you have to get, like, do you mean the abstract idea, like the theoretical idea of data mesh, or do you mean how we actually see it a lot of the time being implemented now? I'm sure there's companies doing much more advanced implementations. But when you talk about actually people having catalogs, people having contracts, people having ways to discover the data, at the moment, these days, they still largely, but not exclusively, mean that through the paradigm of using SQL or things close to SQL and things close to or that actually are a data warehouse or a SQL layer on top of a data lake. In the future, we might be in much more abstract in many different ways, but I think how I see the new ideas being implemented today are not so different from what we've had for a while.
Just recycling, bringing back.
Yeah, and like in formalizing as well. Like, for what I really love about what we're doing, you know, my team's been working on data contracts recently. I really love integrating them in CI/CD processes. I really love making them easily testable for engineers working on product databases and changes to understand the downstream impact. And that's definitely something that was many, many, many times more effort and hard to do and error prone if I go back 10 years. So, like, there are real valuable changes coming here that really allow us to move faster.
Are we catching up a data as a space, catching up with software? And there's, you mentioned CI/CD. Is there a lot we can learn from and implement?
Yes and no. I mean, yes, there is a lot we can learn and implement, and a lot we should learn and implement, particularly around testing, unit integration, end-to-end testing, understanding the differences between them, and having processes in place to automate this. You know, for things like DBT have made it so much more accessible than your average startup. Than, you know, back when I was working with Sky, the big professional ETL tools like ab initio had, in my mind, certainly if you were working in a startup, very high entry costs. They'd probably argue that they were great value as well. That's not necessarily wrong, but they were certainly more expensive than DBT Core as an open source project. So the tools have caught up a bit. And I think our ways of working, our value on it has caught up. And we learn a lot from software engineering. But we should also recognize that there are differences.
Mm-hmm.
There are differences in what we do. In that you release a new product feature.
Yeah.
And it's changed. Or you release a new version of, you know, go back to the classic example of like the Facebook newsfeed. Shows how old I am when I talk about the Facebook newsfeed and everyone hate it when it changed. Like you can learn whether people like that or hate it. And you can let people get used to it over time and you can A/B test it. But that's fundamentally different from, let's say you're working with your finance team and you're building a new revenue model.
Mm-hmm.
And you can show that all your unit tests are right. And you can show that all your integration tests are right. You can show that your end-to-end test is right. I pretty much guarantee you that even if you can show in every logical way that your new financial model is better than your old financial model, they will want to explain just about every cent of difference, you know, every cent of difference for every account before they will be comfortable signing it off. Because they're used to accounting scrutiny, because it really matters what they say to investors. Because when we need to be able to talk differently about how our business is performing because we have a better understanding of our business performance, they need to be able to explain that and they need to be able to react to it in a whole different group of stakeholders. And those different stakeholders, you can't say, I'll take the A group and the B group and my board investors and see which one I win with.
Yeah.
You've actually got to be able to explain it to them. So I think we do face different challenges from software engineering as well, where we need to go beyond where software engineering thinks about test and change and think about the real world impact of test and change, perhaps in a slightly different way to some other groups do as well.
Is the real world impact the big differentiator in personality as well? The traditional software developer is in the zone, in the code, and it's evolved even more. But with data, it's the only reason you're really doing it is for the real world.
Yeah, you're doing it for the real world. One of the things I love about working in data is actually one of the things I learned from Sky is you've got to try and be like obsessed about your customers. You've got to be obsessed with trying to understand your customers. And you know, all the best businesses try to think about their customers and try to understand their customers and talk to their customers and have great research teams. Now, one of the great things about working with data is you are often extremely close to your customers. Obviously, you've got some of your teams building like recommendation models for user customers, and they're in a very similar situation to software engineers in that sense, where we need to learn in different ways. But quite often you're working with a marketing team. Quite often you're working with a FP&A financial planning team. Quite often you're working with a sales team or you're working with a product team in terms of how you do your product analytics. And actually you're next to your customers. And actually you can go and sit with your customers and you can go and work with your customers every day. And when you, even if you have specialized teams, like you've got a marketing analytics team, a product analytics team, it doesn't mean that they should just sit in some data area and occasionally type to their stakeholders on Slack. Like you should go and learn to live their lives. You should go and understand like, what are we actually trying to do with this marketing budget? And even understand, what are we trying to do with this creative process? And that the success of the marketing budget isn't just about how well you understand your channel spread. Some of it is about how well we design our creatives. That's the great advantage of being on a data team, that you should be able to get so much closer to the people that are using it, the people that are changed by it, and really understand what's driving them. And you know, going back to how you feel valued, understanding why they're using you, understanding what problems they've got to solve. You know, that's a classic software problem. Like, go and solve the problems. Don't go and solve things in isolation. Go and find the problems and go and solve the problems. And by getting close to people, that's a great opportunity that we have so much easier than a lot of software engineers.
Is that a detriment to where we could go? I mean, are they meeting in the middle? Are the data folks becoming more like the the customers, and are the customers becoming even more data literate that they could become one?
I don't think they will become one, but I think it's kind of okay. Like, I love a product manager to understand the data. I love a product manager as one of the ways, reasons why I love having a good experimentation platform. I love a product manager to understand why we run a test, what you look for in significance, and that's really easy to ingest, and that it helps them to want to follow this ethos, and it helps them want to test and learn. And I love the fact that my product analysts understand the intent about why are we trying to make a feature better? What do we think it will do for the customer? What impact are we hoping this will have on the business? But it, because it helps them ask better questions and produce better analysis. Now, there comes a point when, you know, sometimes the simple answer isn't enough. And where the simple answer isn't enough, there's always going to be space for a really good product analyst there to help us go better. And that's where they will go better by being deeper with their product managers and deeper with their product knowledge. And they'll work and they'll do the deep dive like together with the product manager. Where yes, at that point, you know, in simple terms, the product analyst is doing the maths, but they're also iterating on what the right questions, how do we break this down in the right way? How do we then describe it when we're going back to talk to the business in terms that are really impactful and lay out the risks and the benefits? And so that we do get closer, we get a bit closer to being one, but I think everyone will still have their specialism. They'll just understand each other better.
Have you seen that evolve since your time at Sky?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I've seen it evolve in my current company just in the last year or so. We've got, particularly in the product area, particularly since we really democratized a bit access to understanding how experiments were going, I've seen like the level on both sides and the level of questioning really start to rise. I've seen like, and it makes a natural desire, which we've fulfilled, to increase the frequency and lower the barrier to testing. So we've done simpler tests, we've done earlier tests. And I've seen the satisfaction that comes from that, in that we've seen more features trending in the right direction, or we've been earlier to able to step back from other features earlier. And we've had fewer sort of high sunk cost decisions where it's difficult to step back from them later. And so like, I definitely see that improvement. I see it in other areas, but that's the one that really springs to mind. Also, like, particularly with all the changes coming in the marketing analytics arena, with where people are increasingly doubtful about where traditional performance measurement will be able to go in the longer term. A real interest in trying to understand techniques like incrementality, a real interest in trying to understand techniques like MMM, and you make like holistic marketing decisions, working with our marketing colleagues who are going to direct the money, and marketing analytics colleagues who can help us understand the impact of that. I've seen a real, I mean, I'm lucky to have some really good teams.
Yeah,
but I've seen a real step change in that in the last year or so as well, in particularly in my area.
Having lucky teams probably speaks volumes about you, Steve. I think is probably a strong indicator.
Like it says on the £2 coin, standing on the shoulders of giants.
Very, very humble of you. Very humble, and we really appreciate you coming on and sharing some of your wisdom with us today. What's coming up? What are you looking into? What are you excited for? For this year,
I'm excited for growth. We've gone through a lot of product change. I'm excited for growth. I'm excited for giving customers a better experience and seeing the benefits of that. I'm strangely excited about business intelligence at the moment. I mean, it's something to be excited about. It's probably a bit personal because it's probably an area where like we haven't super invested in. And actually, we're starting to move forward, and we're sometimes finding it a bit hard to move forward. But actually, we're showing actually making sure everyone's got the same basic understanding, making sure we've got a really good understanding of the drivers is still really valuable things to do. And I'm really excited about just continuing to press forward the culture of learning. We're also, I think, in common with lots of businesses going on this AI journey and working out what does it mean for us. And with that, I'm excited by it. But my watchword is always like, let's make sure we always start with the problem. Let's start with the problem and find out what we've got to solve. And then we'll find out how to solve it. And then we'll find out how to take advantage of the new solutions to do them.
Well, I think AI is probably first time we've had the solution for everything without the problem. It's this big hammer and everything looks like a nail. But finding the problem, I'm with you there. BI is an interesting one to be excited for this year.
It's a really old one, but actually it goes in and out of fashion. It goes in and out of when people do it. And I think that actually good basic reporting was good. Reporting doesn't have to mean dashboards, but good basic business understanding wasn't a driver for every business in the last few years.
No.
And actually, like in this new world, you have to understand, you know, where do you make your money? Where do you lose your money? Like the first advice I got when I started working for Sky, I had a fantastic colleague, a man called Darren Westmore. And he said, when you go out to work with clients, because I'd come from this politics area, he said, follow the money, understand how they make their money, understand where they spend their money, understand how they use their team and their resources to drive their business. And that's how you'll help understand what we can do to make them better. And it's still great advice.
Follow the money. Appreciate you for joining us, Steve. If anyone wants to follow you, check out what you're doing, any events, anything coming up, where people can find you?
You can always find me on LinkedIn. I'm always open up for a conversation on LinkedIn. I'm not an influencer on LinkedIn. I don't tend to write a lot, but I'm always open to talking to people. I'm always open for meeting up with a coffee with leaders and stuff. So get in touch.
Amazing. Appreciate it, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you.